You're listening to The Sky Tonight, looking towards the stars each month on HCR 104 FM.
Hello again and welcome to The Sky Tonight, HCR 104 FM's monthly astronomy show. It's February the 1st and we're looking at the stars and discussing the latest events in space. I'm Pete Singleton and I'm joined by Jonathan Clough, Fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and also of the Cambridge Astronomical Society. We broadcast, of course, across Cambridge on DAB, as well as locally in Huntingdonshire on 104 FM. And you'll find us also on your smart speaker and online. Well, on this edition, we will, of course, talk about all what's going on in space, and we'll also look at some nice winter sights, because the winter sky in the UK is particularly good for looking upwards. So let's kick off then with Jonathan. Hello, Jonathan, and how are you, sir?
Hello, Peter. I'm very well, thank you.
Okay. Well, the big news, of course, from Christmas Day, Jonathan, was the James Webb Space Telescope. This all went well. Everything seems to be going well. It's now, I think, more or less at its the point of its destination. But there's lots and lots of calibration to be had before we start getting anything back. So what's the latest then, Jonathan, on this?
Okay, well, you're quite right in what you just said. The journey from Earth to its parking spot, so to speak, has taken since Christmas Day up till about 30 days in total duration, and there's been some really nice coverage of that by ESA and NASA on the internet. And during that period, it unfolded its telescope mirrors, and we now have this array of 18 golden hexagons all set up as the main mirror on the telescope. It also unfolded its solar shield to keep the sun away from the sensitive parts of the instrument so they can get really cold. So it's now in its fully finished configuration. But the calibration, which you talk about, is the process now of aligning those 18 mirrors. You may remember the old problems with Hubble and the fact that when they finally got it working, the pictures were a bit fuzzy, and that was because there'd been an error in the mirror on Hubble. Now, Hubble only has one mirror, and that was preformed and made on Earth before it launched. With James Webb, they've got these 18 hexagons which have to be aligned to each other, but each hexagon has got a series of motors behind it which are actuated and can be driven, so that the mirrors can all be bent in various different ways and aligned with each other to form the perfect mirror to allow it to take good images. The calibration is frighteningly precise, though. They have to be aligned to within 1/5,000th of the width of a human hair, which is just ridiculous. And it's because it has to be aligned to within a fraction of a wavelength of light, and it's working in the infrared. So it's infrared light, and we have to get it really, really precise. So the way they will do this, in summary, is that they will aim the whole telescope at a star, and they'll take a picture. And they expect that first picture to get 18 images of this star, because they'll get a different image of each of these 18 hexagons. And then they'll start this laborious process of adjusting the mirrors to bring the whole thing into focus. It's just the same as us focusing a telescope or a pair of binoculars, as you gradually bring things into focus. But it's a long-winded process, because you've got to coordinate these actuators for all of these 18 segments. So that will take a few months, but I would hope that we'll see an initial image maybe 2 or 3 months into that process, and they're just about starting it now.
So we're at what they call Lagrange point two, Jonathan. About how far from Earth is that, do we know?
Yes, it's about 1.5 million kilometres away. And if you want to think which direction it's in, it's actually a straight line from the sun through the Earth and then another 1.5 million kilometres out. So it's actually, you almost think it's in the shade of the Earth. It won't be in the shade, because the Earth is relatively small and the sun's very big. So it will actually still get sunlight, However, it is on the side of the Earth which is furthest away from the Sun, so it gets the least amount of interference from the Sun, and it's 1.5 million kilometres from us, and so it will get relatively little interference from us. Plus, it will always be on the night side of the Earth, if you think about it. The right. Sun will be lighting up one side of the Earth, and James Webb will be out on the night side of the Earth, so it will be tucked away 1.5 million kilometres away.
So this really, Jonathan, it's been said that we can almost peer back in time. It's a bit difficult. It's a concept that's very difficult to imagine. What do you think we're going to find out from the observations?
There's three main areas which James Webb has been designed to investigate. The peering back in time is, because this is the most powerful space telescope in terms of its ability to resolve images that we've ever put in space, it will be able to look at images which are further away, or things which are further away, and it will be able to look at them in more detail. And also, because it's an infrared telescope rather than a visual light telescope, it'll be able to see through a certain amount of the gas and dust that's in the way. So that means it will actually be able to see distances which will take us back to the origin of the universe. Sorry, distance and time seem to get mixed together in astronomy. And it's right. If you think about a galaxy which is, let's say, it's 10 billion light years from us, we can see those with our telescopes. And the light from those galaxies has taken 10 billion years to reach us. We think the universe actually began about 13.8 billion years ago. So you're looking back to a time 3.8 billion years after the beginning of the universe. Mm. Now, with James Webb, we think we're going to be able to get to within a few 100,000 years wow. of the beginning of the universe. And that means we can look for clues in the images which we get from that long ago. We can look at galaxies, which are the very first galaxies which evolved. And from those, we can start to extrapolate backwards even further to try and work out what happened with the Big Bang and how things have actually been initiated through the evolution of the universe. So that's the looking back in time and trying to understand the beginning of the universe piece. They believe that by doing some of that, we might actually get some more understanding of these mysterious things called dark matter, dark energy. We've no proof that either of them exist, but there's lots of theories which suggest that they need to exist for us to understand some of the physical actions we see happening in the universe. So they'll be investigating that. And then a little bit nearer to home and a little bit more recently, it's also designed to look at exoplanets. We've talked about exoplanets before. Mm-hmm. But because, once again, it's got greater resolution because of its bigger size, it can look at the light from an exoplanet star as it comes through the atmosphere of that planet on its way to us. And by looking at that light and analysing it, we can look at what gases are in the atmosphere of those exoplanets. And that's a quest for understanding whether there are planets out there who've got the right atmospheric makeup to potentially support life. And I immediately say this will not tell us that there's life on planets. What it will tell us is there's potential for life as we know it on planets. But this is not going to discover life. But it will give us some more clues about the range of different sorts of atmospheres which happen on an exoplanet. And we now have found nearly 5,000 exoplanets, so there's plenty to go on there.
Indeed, and it's going to be very interesting. Just before we leave the JWST, in the launch was a perfect launch. And there must have been a lot of people holding their breath after so many times it's been put off. We were told originally that it would only be a sort of a 10-year life to the telescope. But in fact, I think I'm right in saying, Jonathan, that they do expect to go beyond that now.
Yeah, I mean, the life of the telescope is really determined by two things. One is the fuel it carries to allow it to maneuver. And that fuel was used partly to do the push away from the Earth to head it off towards this parking spot. And then the most recent maneuver, only in the last week, was to slow it down once it got to that parking spot. both of those manoeuvres were carried out perfectly, and there was no additional fuel used. So all that fuel that wasn't used is now available for the operation of the telescope. And it's not stopped still in space at this Lagrange point. It's in what they call a halo orbit, and which means it's just circling around. It's hovering almost in this particular spot. The spot is a gravitationally stable spot, so it doesn't need a lot of energy to stay there, but it will wobble around a bit. And so it needs to be just finely adjusted. About every 3 weeks, they expect to do a little adjustment. And you're quite right. I think they originally thought, or they were guaranteeing in a way, that it would last at least 5 years, the fuel. They're now saying it will last at least 10 years. So we should have at least 10 years of maneuvering capability. The other thing which it needs to be fully operational is its refrigeration, because it's got four main instruments on it. One of them requires absolutely or really, really cold temperatures, and it has effectively a freezer unit on board, and that circulates a liquid within it, just like your fridge at home or your freezer at home, to keep it cold. That's a sealed unit, so in theory it will never need any more liquid to be pumped into it. However, the nature of this liquid is that it does leach away over time, as you probably also found with your freezer at home, and so now and then you need a top up. Now, of course, we aren't in a position to top this up. So the lifetime of that is a little bit unknown. I know Paul was particularly worried about it when we spoke about it before. But that, once again, has a design life of at least 5 years. And then we'll just have to see what happens over time.
Okay, right. Well, let's move on then. What's going on with Blue Origin? I believe they're looking at a possible space station to be built.
They are, yes. And this links into the International Space Station. We've talked about that before. And recently, NASA have announced that the expected lifetime of the International Space Station will be extended. It was actually supposed to be finishing in 2025. It's now been extended out to 2030. So we've got a bit more time on the International Space Station, which has been running beautifully and has been populated the whole time it's been up in orbit. But there is no plan for a Western successor to the International Space Station. Well, there wasn't up until now. And Blue Origin have announced that they will do a commercially developed space station. It's going to be called Orbital Reef. And this space station will be available to any nation, basically, to book laboratory space within it, to put their own astronauts on it, to conduct science experiments. It's a serious space station. It's not a holiday resort. But the idea is that they will put this up and it'll be in a commercial operation. Now, given that it's currently on the drawing board, it's not going to go up into space in the next sort of 2 years. I would expect, if it does go, sometime in the late 2020s.
Yeah.
And that fits in quite nicely with the extended lifetime for the ISS.
Indeed.
So hopefully that'll be up. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Okay, let's now turn our attention to Mars and the little helicopter Ingenuity. It's been performing quite well, hasn't it, of late?
It's been an absolute marvel. You've got this strange situation on Mars where the atmosphere is only about 1% of the density and thickness, if you like, of the atmosphere on the on Earth. So we're all used to helicopters buzzing around on Earth, but for a helicopter to fly on Mars, it has to have rotors going much, much more quickly, and it has to have bigger rotors, basically, to dig into the air. So they weren't sure it would actually fly at all. And it's now flown 18 different flights. It's electrically powered. So in between each flight, it has to sit on the ground and use its solar panels to recharge its batteries. And I think its maximum flight duration is about 90 seconds. So it's not exactly pushing the boat. I mean, I don't think your model helicopter enthusiast here would be very impressed, but it's done really well. And it's now moved from being a concept, you know, it was let's see if we can do this model, into a useful tool. And it's going out and doing reconnaissance for the Perseverance rover and taking photographs, mapping out territory and looking for places where the rover might go next. And because of its altitude and the fact that it can travel much more quickly, it's able to help us be more efficient with our use of Perseverance. So I think you'll see this as a model, for a template, if you like, for future exploration on any planet or any body which we visit which has got an atmosphere.
Indeed. Of course, the flight of the flight of the bumblebee, the flight of the of Ingenuity, of course, It does depend on the weather. Now, we tend to forget about the weather on Mars. There's often sandstorms and poor conditions. So I understand one flight's had to be cancelled or at least postponed.
Absolutely. So that's much more like an Earth situation, isn't it? It was postponed because of sandstorms. And the other thing which they weren't sure about was the effect of temperature, because as the temperatures dropped, it made the atmosphere even less dense. And they weren't sure. And they actually had to adjust the speed of the rotors up to a level beyond what they'd originally thought in order to give it enough purchase on the atmosphere in these new conditions. So we're also already used to the rovers having to shut down from time to time when there's sandstorms. And we've had issues with previous rovers where they've had to close down altogether because they've had sand across the solar panels and they've lost all power.
That's right, indeed.
So far, we're okay with both of these. The air traffic control on Mars had to postpone a flight due to sandstorm. So business as normal is resumed.
And of course, the business of what the rover's finding out goes on with rocks and that. It's the Perseverance has visited Jezero crater, hasn't it, Jonathan? And it's looking at some organic molecules or something. Is that right?
That's right. The whole mission, it landed in the Jezero crater, which is in this delta. Just clearly looking at the images, you can see it looked just like a river delta on Earth, obviously apart from the water. And the images that have come back now have been directly comparable with images you can take on Earth of river deltas. You can see the sediment layers in the walls of the delta. And so what Perseverance is doing is taking samples at various different spots across the delta to try to understand what's happened over time. And in fact, one of the most recent findings is that they are now confirming that there's actually more water in that area over, eons ago, not recently, than they thought originally. So just confirming, really, that Mars was a wet planet and had oceans, subsequently lost them all. But that's being validated, and there's some water still on the planet. It's sort of in the rocks, and you can theoretically extract it. So when you get to thinking about missions to Mars, and we're also looking at the Moon in the same context, is it should be possible to extract water, and water is hydrogen and oxygen. So by definition, oxygen to breathe and hydrogen to use for fuel from the rocks on the Mars and on the Moon.
Good. Okay, Jonathan, then we must take a break. We'll just mention SpaceX and one or two other things when we come back after this short break, and then we'll get on to what you can see in the night skies. Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. I'm Pete Singleton, and with me is Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. All right, we're going to continue with one or two stories on the current space missions, Jonathan. So let's look at what SpaceX is doing. Now, the Starship and the Super Heavy, they're the big things for SpaceX.
They are, and at this point we're still waiting. The Federal Aviation Authority are still conducting their survey of the environmental impact of the launches which are planned. They are supposed to come up with a final decision on that, maybe as soon as the end of February. So before we get to our next program, it's possible that there will have been a launch.
Why are they being so fussy? I mean, it's not like the first time that SpaceX has launched.
I think what it is a response to the plans which SpaceX have put together about the number of launches, because so far they haven't launched Super Heavy, and it is a massive rocket. You remember Saturn V's. So you put a Starship on top of a Super Heavy, it's bigger than a Saturn V.
Yes, yes.
And I think their plan was to do, I think, at least 10 launches a year.
Right.
And they were going to do it from their Texas base. I think it was Texas. And so as a result of this plan being proposed, the FAA went out and said, basically launched a questionnaire and asked for public comment on the situation. And they got, I think, 18,000 responses, which they're having to sift through. So it's processed because of the increase. I mean, up to now, the number of launches has been relatively low. They've had to give case-by-case approval, But now SpaceX is saying, look, can we just not operate as a spaceport? And of course, in parallel, SpaceX are looking at sea launches. And this is one of the reasons why, because this will be a, if you lived next to one of these, you'd know about it. And if they were having a launch every other day, it would It would disrupt your Zoom calls and nothing else.
Well, it certainly would. It definitely would, yeah. So we're looking at the end of possibly the next launch is going to be in March. And this is going to be an orbital flight of the Starship.
That's the idea, is it would be a Starship being launched on top of Super Heavy. And would put Starship into a single orbit, and it would then come back and land back at the place it's been launched from. The booster, the Super Heavy, would also come back and land. This is a great part of the SpaceX mindset, is that they don't allow things to get wasted. So at the moment, however, we have an example of the old philosophy with a SpaceX booster actually just about due to hit the moon. And this is back from one of their 2015 launches.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah. They launched some satellites back in 2015, and the booster didn't end up where they expected it to. I think at that stage they weren't recovering them. I think it would have been expected just to crash in the Pacific, like most of these things do, and burn up in re-entry. But something didn't go quite to plan. The satellites went okay, but the booster ended up in what they call a chaotic orbit, which means it was in orbit around the Earth, but a very long orbit, which actually takes it out beyond the orbit of the moon as part of its orbit every time. And it's been doing this for the last 7 years. And for a while, it was lost altogether. People didn't know where it was. But the tracking has now been reestablished. We know where it is. And we also know that on its next orbit, it will actually impact on the back of the moon as it comes back towards the Earth. I don't know what people's feelings are about this. I'd probably rather it hit the moon than it hit the Earth, as we wouldn't know where on Earth it would hit. We're causing more space litter, frankly. However, it's an opportunity for some science, as the actual impact, because we know it's going to happen, can be observed, not by us because it's on the back of the moon, but it can be observed by spacecraft which are in the right places, and we can see what the impact does and see what gets lifted up. So it would also allow these seismometers on the moon to measure that impact through the moon, which will help us get better understanding of how the moon's constructed. So, you know, we opportunity out of adversity, eh?
Absolutely. And I remember back to the Apollo days when they released the upper lunar module, not the landing stage, the upper part of it, when the astronauts were safely back in the command ship, was what once or twice they fired the lunar module at the moon. And of course, the seismometers they left behind you can see the effect of those hitting the moon's surface. And I presume, I mean, I think there's one or two things from the Apollo days which are still, you know, still working.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the seismometers from Apollo are still working. They left a reflector.
Reflector mirrors,
Yeah, which is used to measure the distance of between the Earth and the moon. You can shine a laser at the moon, hit the mirror, it bounces back. So, yes, that's still there. No, it's fascinating.
Okay, I think we ought to mention the Starlink satellites in passing.
Yes, we've got through another milestone. SpaceX have launched more than 2,000 Starlink satellites now. They have an intention to launch about 30,000 altogether, but they don't have a license for that yet. This is something else which the Federal Communications Commission are looking at doing. At the moment, SpaceX are authorized to launch 4,408 satellites. And when you consider that when they started, there weren't many more than 5,000 or 6,000 satellites in orbit. So SpaceX on its own is more or less doubling the satellite count on their existing license. If they put 30,000 up, then they will have, I don't know what the right number is, sort of six times as many satellites will be up there. But I also heard in the news in the last few days that the Chinese are now also talking about launching tens of thousands of satellites as well, presumably for a similar reason. So it's getting worse.
Okay. We have to move on. Let me just mention China. It's hoping to complete its space station. Another huge year in space for China, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't get as much press about the Chinese. I mean, we saw the launch or the landings on the moon last year, and they put their rover on the moon, and they put a landing on Mars as well. But the space station sort of doesn't seem to get much press. But they now have their own space station. They have launched additional modules up to it. They have crews going to it, and they had more launches last year than any other nation. And that includes the SpaceX constellation. So, you know, China is really going something. Their third crewed mission up to space station is actually going to be up there shortly. I think it goes on March the 7th. Oh, no, it goes quite soon anyway. So another set of us astronauts will be up there. They're completing the assembly with these additional units. And they'll have more units going up in June and August. And so the space station is growing. It's a little bit like the way the International Space Station grew back in the day.
Is it at a higher point than the International Space Station, or is it lower?
I think it's at about the same level. And I say both of them will have a degree of manoeuvrability.
Sure.
I know the International Space Station does have to do fairly frequent manoeuvres in order to stay well clear of other stuff that's flying around in orbit. So I'm pretty certain the Chinese space station is about the same altitude. I'll check that. We'll be able to talk about that next month.
Okay. I think we ought to get on to the February night sky, Jonathan. It's particularly good, of course. The winter night sky in the UK is great, particularly good for looking upwards. So what have you got to tell us? We've got a full moon on the 15th of the 16th of February.
Yes, we do. I actually haven't got any notes about what the old farmer's almanac says about the full moon.
Oh, no. Never mind.
What I will say, though, is that if it's clear skies on the around about the 9th of February, you'll get a really nice view of the moon. It won't be full because it's full on the 16th, so it's a week before it's full. But it'll be in between the Pleiades and the Hyades. And just to remind people, the Pleiades is also called the Seven Sisters, and it's a very nice star cluster, which you can see with the naked eye. It appears as a little fuzzy spot, but once you've actually found it, you can usually identify a few stars in it. And then depending on how young your eyes are, you'll count more or less. I mean, Seven Sisters, I think somebody with reasonably good eyesight will usually see the seven brightest stars in the Pleiades. Mm. But if you're a bit older like me, you see a few less. But it depends so much on how clear the sky is.
Yes.
But we've had some lovely clear nights through January and into February. Mm. So let's hope those carry on. The Hyades, by the way, that's another star cluster. And the Hyades are it's a slightly broader cluster, more spread out, and it's the head of the bull of Taurus. So if you can find the orangey-red star Aldebaran, which is the eye of the bull of Taurus, that is the base of a V, and the V is where the Hyades are. So that gives you some indication. And, you know, to find them, look at the moon on the 9th of February, and it'll be right bang in between the Hyades and the Pleiades.
Okay. Towards the planets then, Venus, Mercury and Mars, especially good at the start of February.
We're in a period now where most of the good planets to observe are in the morning sky rather than the evening sky. And you've got Venus, Mercury and Mars. In fact, somebody in my local WhatsApp group posted a rather nice photo of Venus this morning. So if you are up as the sun's rising, preferably just before the sun's risen, so you don't have the sun interfering too much, but you can see Venus in the lightening sky. It's so bright, it can actually cope with the sky being a bit lighter. Mars and Mercury are also there, but you won't see those once the sky is getting brighter. So if you get up a little bit earlier, and you look in that area where you can see this really bright star of Venus, you may also see the red planet Mars, and you might also see Mercury, although Mercury won't be around for very long. So good luck. In terms of the evening sky, Jupiter's still around, but it's very, very low in the early evenings and only for the next couple of weeks. And after that, it'll disappear off. If you have a telescope, you will be able to see Uranus high in the sky. And in fact, in the evening viewing, that's the best planet to look for. However, you will need a telescope or binoculars to see that. And you need to know exactly where to put it, look for it. It's in the constellation of Aries at the moment in the early evening. The nice thing is it's easier to see things when they're higher in the sky. And Uranus is actually higher in the sky at the moment.
Right.
The other thing which I was quite fortunate to manage to see a couple of weeks ago was Ceres, which is a dwarf planet. It's the largest asteroid. It's about 1,000 kilometers across. And once again, it's currently traveling through Taurus. And if you manage to find it, you will see Ceres, which not many people have seen. It's a little bit like seeing Mercury. You know, not many people have seen it, but everyone's heard of it. Ceres, not many people have heard of either. So you could actually tick that one off in your iSpy book.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Can we see Neptune at all in the evening sky?
It's very low in the evening sky, and it's also very small. So you may be able to see it if you have a very clear evening, and you can catch it low in the sky near the horizon.
Hmm. All right. Now then, I understand there's some comets that we can possibly see, Jonathan. What have you got to tell us about comets?
Well, apart from them being very awkward customers, you predict you can see the comets and then you very, very can't. But last year we were quite lucky. Was it last year? We did actually manage to see a visible a comet, which you could see with the naked eye. A comet 19P Borelli is going to be tracking closest to the sun today, actually, February the 1st. It's in the southwest sky, and it's actually in the constellation of Pisces. And then it'll track on into Aries, then on to Perseus. It's going to be in the sky all through the evening. And we think it's going to, the initial observations say it's got a good coma and a tail. Now, all of that's all good. It's going to be very, very faint. And comets tend to be little fuzzy blobs. So if you do see something in those locations you just went through and it is a little fuzzy blob, it may well be Comet 19P Borelli. You may see something which actually looks quite good. If you've got a pair of binoculars, you may be able to make out more detail. And I managed with the comet last year to get a picture which showed the tail just using my little compact camera and a bit of zoom. And that worked very well. So it's worth a try. And then we also have a second comet, Comet 2019 L3 Atlas, and that's in Gemini in the evenings. And Gemini is nice and high in the sky again. We'll talk about that again in a minute. That is a fuzzy blob, and the reason that's a fuzzy blob is it's not side on to us. All we will see is this fuzzy blob. So once again, it's worth having a look. I'm trying to catch these with my telescope and camera at the moment. I've had a little bit of success, but I haven't got any really nice comet-looking photographs. I've just got fuzzy blobs so far.
Okay. We can perhaps carry on with that a little bit in more detail in the next section, Jonathan, but we must take a short break. Back in a moment. Welcome back to The Sky Tonight with me, Pete Singleton, and Jonathan Clough from the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Now, we've already mentioned, Jonathan, winter time in the UK is a great period, sort of time to be looking up at the sky in the evening. There's lots of bright winter stars, and there's also something I understand called the winter hexagon. Perhaps you can tell our listeners what the winter hexagon actually is.
Certainly, and you're quite right. I mean, there's nothing, you can't beat a really dark night with a clear sky, and you can see all the stars shining in the sky. And it's nice to be able to sort of work your way around them. One constellation which most people are familiar with is Orion. And often know where Orion's belt is, and then you can work out from where his belt is that he's got 2 feet and two shoulders. I'm going to start with Orion's left foot.
Right.
And that's left as he's looking at us, not as we're looking at him. And that's Rigel. And Rigel is a bright star. It's actually a blue supergiant. So it's a very large star, but it's a long way away. It's relatively young. It's only about 8 million years old. And the sneaky fact here is it's not one star. It's actually four stars, which are so close together that in the naked eye, it looks like a single star. It's about 860 light years away. So it's quite a long way away. And in fact, from all the stars we're going to talk through, that's the one which is furthest out. But because it's so huge, it's 300,000 times as bright as our sun. Even though it's a long way away, it still seems very bright. So you're looking at Orion and you're looking at his left foot, and that's Rigel. And if you track to the left from Rigel and down a bit, you will see a very, very bright star. It's actually the brightest star in the sky in either the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. It's called Sirius. And it's in the constellation Canis Major, which is the big dog. Mm. And I always remember this by thinking, well, Orion's a hunter and he's got his hunting dogs.
Yeah.
And so, Canis Major is his big one. And we will come to his small one in a minute. So Sirius is a very, very bright star. It's the brightest star we can see. It's much closer than Rigel. It's about 100 times closer. It's only 8.5 light years away, but it's a much smaller star. It's not that dissimilar to our sun. It's a bit bigger, but not too bad. And it also has a companion, but this is only it's a binary system in this case. But so you can see Sirius, you can point it out, and you can talk about Orion and his hunting dogs, which is very nice. And then if you track up and to the left from Sirius, you'll find another bright star. And this one is called Procyon, which is a name which people aren't so familiar with. But this is the biggest and brightest star in the constellation of Canis Minor. And if you remember Canis Major, then you can remember Canis Minor. So this is Orion's little dog, Canis Minor. It's a similar distance away to Sirius, and it's actually a little bit bigger, but not a huge amount different. Excuse me. And it's also a binary system, but it's starting to take you around this hexagon. So we started with Rigel, we've gone to Sirius, we've gone to Procyon. So we've actually got three of the corners of the hexagon now. And I say, this is a rather wonky hexagon, so you'll have to bear with me on this. It doesn't work all the way around. We go up from Procyon, in Canis Minor, and directly above it, pretty much in the sky, you'll find a pair of stars. And this pair are Castor and Pollux. So I'm cheating here. I'm making this one corner, but it's actually two stars. And Castor and Pollux are the twins, and that's Gemini. Yeah, and Gemini is quite nice to see because you do have these two stars together, and you can usually see the two stars. And if the sky is really dark, you can start to see that each of them is the brightest star in a sort of line of stars, which forms the bodies of Castor and Pollux, the twins. Castor is an amazing setup because it's actually six stars again, and it's a combination of stars orbiting each other in various different combinations. I won't go through all of the different orbits, but it's a fascinating little constellation in itself, and that's the big boy in Castor in Gemini. So we've now got to the fourth corner of the hexagon, and we're now going to sweep across to the right, and this is actually a star which is more or less directly above Rigel. So we're going back across the sky, but it's much, much higher in the sky. And it's a star called Capella. Once again, it's a bright star. It's about 80 times as luminous as our sun in terms of its brightness, but it's 43 light years away. So it's obviously not as bright as our sun. It's in the constellation of Auriga. Now, Capella is an interesting setup as well because it's a binary pair of yellow giants and a binary pair of red dwarfs. Auriga is the goat. And if you manage to get a pair of binoculars and find Auriga, Capella I'm talking about, you might be able to see a little triangle of faint stars right next to it. And those are known as the kids. So Auriga is the constellation of the goat. And it has its kids nearby. So that's the link together there. Mm. And then our last stop on this journey around the hexagon is going back down again towards Rigel, stopping about halfway. And I've mentioned this star already in the previous segment, which is Aldebaran, which is this great big red giant. And it's the eye of the bull of Taurus. It's a red giant. This is the oldest star on our journey. It's 6.5 billion years old. So it's twice as old as our own sun. It's about the same mass as our sun, but because it's nearing the end of its life, It's run out of fuel. It's collapsed in on itself, and then it's rebounded, and it's about 45 times the size of our sun because it's rebounded and got bigger. And that's why it's gone red, because it's having to spread its heat across the whole surface. And so it's actually cooler on the surface than our sun is, even though it started off at about the same. So that's the sixth star in our hexagon. So we've gone around from Rigel in Orion, Sirius, the big dog, Procyon, the little dog, Castor and Pollux in Gemini, Capella up in Auriga, the goat, and then down to Aldebaran, the eye of the bull. Now, those are all in a nice area of the sky. You can see them whenever it's a nice clear night. And if you can find Orion, you should be able to find your way around them.
That's good, Jonathan. Thanks ever so much for that. Just before we move on, I've just been having a look at what happened on this day, or nearly on this day, in space history. And 55 years ago, in fact, on the 27th of January, which was last week, the Apollo 1 fire happened. Now, this was a very, a tragic event when they were doing a test, a sort of a dry test for the first Apollo manned flight, and Virgil, Grissom, White and Chaffee were sadly killed in that fire. I remember this, you know, because, I mean, it was the year I started school, and I remember seeing the reports, and because I got sort of interested in space before that date, but it was something which was, you know, always stuck in my mind, seeing the news reports about that. And it just reminds us that you know, space is dangerous, isn't it?
It is, and obviously we've had the two space shuttle disasters since then, and the Russians have had a few problems over time as well, and there have been unfortunate deaths in the Russian program. I think we have to expect that it will happen again, but we just, obviously, everybody works very hard to make things as safe as they possibly can. And the most recent casualty is actually that co-pilot on the Virgin spacecraft, wasn't it, during a test flight?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it is a dangerous occupation, and we have to have great respect for the astronauts, the cosmonauts, and Chinese taikonauts.
Taikonauts.
Who fly these rockets. I mean, you're basically getting onto a great big explosion and keeping your fingers crossed as it takes you up into space.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to happier things. What's going on? Jonathan, with your association at Cambridge, your upcoming events.
Yeah, well, we have a full program again for February. The first thing in our calendar is for our Cambridge Astro Plus group, which is, it's really the group which our young astronomers graduate up to. It's really from anybody aged about 12 upwards. And on Monday, the 7th of February, we're going to have a session in the evening at 7:15 called About the Red Planet. So you can guess it's all about Mars, and we'll be talking about different topics on Mars. All of these sessions are a similar format in that we have three or four speakers talking about different aspects, but within the same topic area. So anybody who goes to our website will be able to find the link to that. It doesn't cost you anything, and we would welcome any of the listeners to join us for that. They're quite interactive and popular sessions. But later in the month, we have on Friday the 18th of February, we have our monthly speaker evening. And our speaker on this occasion is a lady called Teresa Pulterova, who is a senior reporter for space.com. So she writes, you often see her articles popping up on the internet. And she's going to talk about mega constellations. So back to what we were talking about with SpaceX earlier on. That should be quite an interesting talk. And I asked her to give this talk, actually, because of some things she'd written online. And we're trying to sort of just follow that up. And our final event for the month is our young astronomers. So once again, it's a busy group. This one's on a Saturday morning, Saturday the 26th of February, 10 o'clock. And we're sticking with the Mars theme. This is about roving Mars. So given that this year we will be back to Mars with new landers, so this is a two-year cycle. So more stuff will go to Mars. So we're trying to equip people with the information about that. And also in Cambridge, we work with the Cambridge Institute of Astronomy, have a public viewing session every Wednesday. You're very welcome to join those online. Go to the Institute of Astronomy website, and then you can watch a talk, which is given on YouTube, followed by live observing, courtesy of the Cambridge Astronomical Association, where we wheel our telescopes out and freeze ourselves to death in the garden, trying to show you live images. And actually, I did, you know, so that's where I managed to get my comet photos, so you never know. So around the region, I've checked. I couldn't find anything for Papworth Astronomy Club. If anybody is listening from there, then they have other events, they should let us know. Letchworth and District Astronomical Society have got a talk, and it's their monthly meeting about the solar cycle by Lynn Smith. And the solar cycle is interesting. We're just coming out of a solar minimum, and so the sun is getting busier. There are more and more sunspots, and that in turn lends itself to more magnetic activity on Earth. So things like the Northern Lights, and maybe other solar storm-initiated problems will be getting greater and greater. So that's on February the 23rd in the evening at 7:30. And then finally, the St. Neots Astronomy Association, they have some weekend observing on the 7th of February, and that's at Little Paxton Pitts Nature Reserve.
Good. Well, that's really good. Lots going on in the area. And if there's anybody who wants to email us with a question, on anything at all, well, please do get in touch with us. The email address is skytonight@hcrfm.co.uk, and we will do our very best to answer the question for you on the next available show. Well, we mentioned on this day, I don't know that you've picked anything up sort of this time, Jonathan, for that.
I haven't got anything particularly historic at the moment. I must say, we are in this time of we're going through the 50th anniversary of a lot of the Apollo activities.
Indeed.
So that will carry on. I think 69 was the first moon landing. The landing's carried on till 72. So in 2022, will be the 50th anniversary of our final moon landing up to now.
Indeed.
So hopefully the Artemis program will get us back on the moon. And if the Artemis program doesn't, I get the Chinese might get there first, actually, at the moment.
Well, that is a possibility, I have to say. Then, of course, Eugene Cernan will no longer be the last man on the moon.
And That's right.
As I understand it, there's probably a big push for the next person to stand on the moon to be a woman, which I think is quite good.
Quite right, absolutely. It's a stated intent for the Artemis program is the first moon landing, which will be, or the first manned moon landing, will be the Artemis 3 mission, and that will include a woman and a man. I think they're talking about there being two astronauts, but we do know that they're going with spacecraft capable of carrying more, so heaven knows.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that day, I can tell you. Okay, well, I think, Jonathan, we've got to round up the evening, so thank you very much, as always, for your preparation and your input. This has been The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. Presented by me, Pete Singleton, with input from Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Coming up at 10, it's The Late Show with Tony Obie. Following the news and local weather at 8, it's Rock and Roll with John Rea. We are back with you on Tuesday, March the 1st, for another edition of The Sky Tonight. But from all of us in this particular part of the universe, until next time, we wish you a very good night. Good night, Jonathan, and good night to our listeners.